Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
She hadn't been dead very long. She wasn't there very long. She was still warm for being October, and there's a lot of coyotes and other animals out there that fortunately something didn't get her and drag her off someplace that would have never have found her. She was just freshly murdered.
Every year in the U.S., law enforcement investigates thousands of new and old homicide cases that involve unidentified victims. They could be runaways, prostitutes, or people living off the grid with no family looking for them. In 1980, near the Arroyo Grande Wash in Henderson, Nevada, one such Jane Doe was found, discarded, naked, and brutalized, with few clues to her identity. Dubbed Jane Arroyo Grande Doe, she would be forgotten today if not for the dedication of two homicide detectives, generations apart, who refused to give up on finding her name and finding her killer. I'm Steve French, and this is Unsolved Mysteries, The Girl with the S Tattoo.
It was October 5th, 1980. It was a Sunday evening when I got the call.
In 1980, John Williams is a 30-year-old homicide detective with the Henderson Police Department.
Two brothers that live in Henderson were driving State Route 146, and they stopped basically to relieve themselves. It was dark out. It was 9 o'clock at night, and they saw her laying there. So they drove back into the police department, and I was on call that weekend. I went to the police department, interviewed them to find out exactly where it was, and then drove out to the scene where Jane was. Arroyo Grande was just a little dirt turnoff. It wasn't a major road at that time. I pulled over, and there she was laying on her belly, totally nude, in a little area up in the dirt road. She had 7 puncture wounds to her back from a 2-prong instrument, 16th inch in diameter, and numerous injuries to her back of her head with what appeared to be a hammer. That was basically the worst part of her injuries. And when we turned her over and looked at her face, she had been punched, beat up in the face. They just took her out there and dumped her. She was 16 to 20. Her height was 5'3". She weighed 106 pounds, and she had blondish brown hair. She had a small tattoo in her inner right forearm of the letter S as in Sam. Cause of her death was a blunt trauma to her head, and just a young girl.
The girl's body is found at the side of the only road leading out of Henderson to Interstate 15, which runs west to California and east to Las Vegas, In 1980, Henderson is still more desert than town, with a population of only 21,000. Detective John Williams has been with the department for almost a decade by then, and he's seen his share of homicide investigations.
There was not a lot of them. Domestic homicides, that was probably the major ones we handled.
As he begins his investigation of the scene, Williams has no way of knowing that the mystery of this young girl's brutal death will haunt him for the next 40 years. The position of her body is his first clue.
She was laying straight out on her belly with her arms both down her sides, and she was just laid there, basically a perfect position. She was killed elsewhere and then just taken out there and positioned. There was nothing around there where it showed where the murder occurred there, because with all the injury to the back of her head and her facial injury, it would have been pretty messy. There would have been blood all over. Her feet was not dirty. I mean, it would like if she'd be walking barefooted or nothing, there was no dirt on them. She was clean, like she had been scrubbed before she was placed there. Her face was bloody, but the rest of her body was, I mean, it was no dirt and stuff, and like she was maybe wrapped in something and taken out there and just lifted off and laid down, and whoever did it probably wanted just to get rid of as much evidence possibly as they could, and then maybe they wrapped her into something, just took her out of the wrapping and put her there.
Williams recovers a piece of evidence that seems to confirm his suspicion, a piece of plastic which turns out to be a section of a shower curtain. An autopsy reveals that the girl has been sexually assaulted.
They brutally did that to her, but then they cleaned her and everything and took her out and just laid her like that. It was just different.
The finding of this girl on that dark, desolate road touches John deeply. He begins to think of her as a member of his own family.
My wife and I and a couple other officers from the police department bought a headstone and had it, her name, Jane Arroyo Grande Doe, and the date of death and everything, and so we had her buried.
Who is this young girl? And who could have committed this horrific crime? Williams has almost nothing to go on, and the age of forensic DNA won't begin for another 20 years. He hires a sketch artist to develop a likeness of the girl, and Williams canvasses the county with flyers trying to identify her.
I thought at first it would be easy because, with her being a young girl, somebody would have reported someone like her missing, but we couldn't find anything like that. She obviously wasn't local. We had no missing girls in the Henderson, Las Vegas area that fit her. I was thinking maybe she might have been a runaway and was maybe coming from California or that area, the West area, and somebody might have picked her up hitchhiking.
Well, Henderson police still hoping to solve a 30-year-old murder mystery.
And for 36 years, Henderson police haven't been able to figure out who this young girl is.
Gonzalez opens one of the oldest cold cases we have.
Detective John Williams retires in 2006, with Jane Arroyo Grande Doe still on his mind.
I handled 329 death investigations, homicide, suicides, and different deaths. Jane Arroyo Grande Doe was the only one who's been unsolved.
If it wasn't for John, I don't think that this case would still be alive today.
Henderson Detective Joe Ebert takes up the case in 2014 when John Williams retires.
Before I took it over, John Williams looked at this case in a personal fashion. He is the one that paid for Jane Arroyo Grande's burial. He looked at her as almost like his own daughter. Literally from 1980 to 2006, when he retired, he worked this case, did everything he could to try to solve it. I've known John all my life, and to be able to help with the case is an honor to me. So I have involved John in the entire process of the investigation that I've done.
Detective Joe Ebert is the son of a Henderson police officer. Law enforcement is all he ever wanted to do. He was 6 years old on October 5th, 1980, when Jane Doe was found. He grew up under the legend of this cold case and John's quest to solve it.
There's two mysteries in this case. The second mystery will be to solve who killed Jane Arroyo Grande Doe. The first mystery is to solve who Jane Arroyo Grande Doe is.
The Henderson Police Department reached out to Fox 5 and asked for our help to bring publicity to a cold case.
It involves a young teenage girl who was found...
First, Joe sets out to remind the local public of the murder, and he gets help from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to push the campaign further.
Maybe make her face known across the country, rather than just here in Henderson, for example. Throwing her picture in a paper in the Henderson Home News or the Las Vegas Review-Journal isn't national news. But if we could get her face pushed across the country, we were hoping that somebody would recognize her. And that's exactly what we did from the start.
Joe also buries himself in the Henderson PD evidence room. He knows that he has something John Williams never did in 1980, the help of modern forensic science, like DNA technology.
Although DNA didn't exist, there was still procedures set in place because they knew that certain things would happen in the future that would ultimately help identify victims, identify suspects. So they took pieces of evidence back then in 1980 to ultimately use in the future. So first thing I did was go through each piece of evidence piece by piece until I knew exactly what we had left, exactly what we had in our storage, and knew what we had that we could work with. We had some hair that was cut at autopsy. We had some vaginal swabs, anal swabs. She was brutally murdered, but she was also sexually assaulted. With the swabs, we were able to recover some spermatoza from a male suspect, and those were put on cytoslides. We had old radiographs. Radiographs are imagery taking of the dental work of the victim. We had a shower curtain, piece of a shower curtain that was recovered at the scene. Quite a bit of different pieces of evidence that were stored down there.
But Joe discovers that having biometric material is not the same as having extractable DNA. Take, for example, the strands of hair removed from Jane's body during the autopsy.
It was not plucked or pulled hair, so it had no root, but it was cut hair at autopsy, which at the time, no one really knew that cut hair at autopsy rather than a pulled hair with a root attached to it would be less valuable or more valuable. They just did that. They packaged it.
Pulling DNA from Jane's hair is going to be difficult, but there are other options. Joe hopes to compare Jane's dental work with the database of missing girls compiled at the National Crime and Information Center. But there's a problem.
It just so happens that the radiographs were not good anymore. They were destroyed, so they basically turned black over a period of time. And the radiographs of her dental work, we couldn't use to exclude any of the victims that we had in the NCIC list that had been reported missing.
Then there is the spermatozoa recovered from the victim, ideally a perfect way to match DNA with sexual assault suspects.
So what happened back in 1980 is when they glue cytoslides together with the spermatozoa that was on it, it just so happened that the glue they used degraded the DNA that we had from the suspect. The last time we tried to get DNA from the spermatozoa on Jane Arroyo Grande Doe, we failed. So although it's not completely gone, there's just a little bit of that left. We are kind of at a stalemate, if you want to call it that. We're waiting for maybe technology to get a little better so that we can ultimately try it again.
With radiographs, hair samples, and spermatozoa from the suspect all failing to yield anything workable, Joe is left with one option.
We had to exhume her. We got with John Williams again. I felt it was important for him to be part of the exhumation process, which he was. And she has still exhumed to this day. We had made the decision that we would do everything we could to try to identify her. Once we exhumed her, we would not reinter her until we could put a name on the headstone rather than Jane Arroyo Grande Doe. As sad as it was, her crypt leaked and filled with water. So the water degraded a lot of the bones for DNA, which kind of hindered us in what we wanted to do with the DNA side. But we were successful with the radiographs.
The new radiographs reveal that Jane Arroyo Grande Doe has a unique identifying characteristic. She had received dental work not long before she was murdered, and the evidence was still in her jaw.
She had in her teeth an eye hook ligature. It wasn't installed and left in her mouth for years. It was installed so that it would straighten an eye tooth. And once that happens, they remove the eye hook ligature. So the eye hook ligature was still implanted in her jaw. So the fact that that was there tells everyone that's looked at this case that she had recently seen either a orthodontist or a dentist, which means that she obviously was probably taken care of by someone. She also had multiple other work done to her teeth, which included fillings that obviously somebody had to pay for. So she was someone who I believe was cared for. The eye hook ligature that was put in her mouth to straighten the eye tooth is something that not everybody would do. It's like braces. She was under the care of an orthodontist or a dentist not too long before she was murdered. We were hoping that someone would remember putting an eye tooth ligature in somebody's mouth and then not ever having that person come back in to get it removed. We pushed it out through the American Dental Association, through different forensic odontologists, through numerous different organizations across the country. And we just haven't had any luck with anybody coming forward saying, I was the orthodontist. I remember installing this eye hook ligature in a young female to straighten an eye tooth, and she never came back into my office. And maybe because that person isn't around anymore or is so old that they don't remember.
As efforts to find a name for Jane Doe come up empty, Detective Ebert turns to the second mystery, the identity of her killer. One theory leads him to a string of murders in the area from 1978 to 1981, and he keys in on one potential suspect, a serial killer named Stephen Peter Morin.
So in the Clark County area, there's approximately 12 cases tied to Stephen Peter Morin. I believe 9 of them are with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and 3 of them are with our agency. And although they're not confirmed, they're believed to be somehow connected to Stephen Peter Morin.
Morin traveled the country from New York to California and is linked to as many as 48 murders. At the time of Jane's death, Morin is living in Las Vegas under the alias Robert Generoso, and he's married with a young son. In December of that year, police target him for the murder of a Nevada woman found in the Utah desert. Morin flees the state.
Through the investigation, it was determined that he used to come to Henderson to sell drugs and to different areas of Nevada where all 3 of our victims were found.
Stephen Peter Morin spends 6 years on the FBI's most wanted list until 1982 when he is arrested at a bus station in Texas. He's charged with murdering 2 women in that state.
Prior to ever being able to interview Stephen Peter Morin, he was executed and cremated. And again, this was back in 1985 when he was executed, so DNA didn't really exist back then for us. They did take some samples of tissue that they believed were going to be something that we could use in the future, but those 2 pieces of tissue that were taken from Stephen Peter Morin were horrible sources of DNA. They didn't know that at the time, but we haven't been able to do a lot with it. But in the process of it, we did know that he had a biological son. And after working with attorney's offices and his son, we were able to obtain DNA from him.
But Morin's DNA is only one piece of the puzzle. Joe has a decision to make. Should he try and compare it with the remains of the already degraded spermatozoa taken from Jane more than 40 years ago? He consults with specialists and decides against it, for now.
So we're holding off on that. We don't want to waste it. Take a chance of not obtaining anything like we did a couple of years ago and then have no more DNA left to test in the future, if you know what I mean. Every few months, we're making leaps and bounds in DNA technology, and it's just a matter of time before science breaks it down and is able to recover the DNA that we haven't been able to get so far.
Shopping can be a lot of fun, right? But you know what else is fun? Saving money. And Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop. Get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every single category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, and so much more. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while you're doing it? It's a no-brainer. Shop brands like Macy's, Bluemercury, Petco, Nike, Urban Outfitters, Neiman Marcus, and so much more. Here's how it works. The stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via check or PayPal quarterly. Maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons. Rakuten has 17 million members who are already saving. Why not join them? Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. Cashback rates change daily. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app and start saving today. Your cashback really adds up with Rakuten, R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Hey, Unsolved Mysteries listeners. I'm here to tell you that there's no reason to panic the next time you're searching for the perfect gift. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. There's a lot of pressure around gifting. I usually have a hard time thinking of gift ideas for family members, and sometimes I get super stressed trying to find the perfect thing. But now with Gift Mode on Etsy, I can search hundreds of gifting personas and find so many incredible items. And I actually just found the perfect gift for my fitness fanatic sister. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
If Stephen Peter Morin did kill Jane and at least two other young women found in the Henderson area, what did their murders have in common? Were the other victims scrubbed clean like Jane?
That is definitely a different aspect of the murder. But as far as the way the body was positioned, the way that the victim was killed, they all match specifically the other victims that we have. All blunt force trauma. One of them was face down, positioned almost identical to Jane Arroyo Grande. The only difference was she was wearing socks. Other than that, she was completely nude. Then there was another victim who was positioned very similar, but facing up and also completely nude, wearing socks, but also was killed with blunt force trauma to the head. And all three of them were sexually assaulted. But he also had inconsistencies on how he killed them. Stephen Peter Morin is potentially responsible for killing 48 different women, but he killed them in multiple ways. He used sharp instruments. He used rocks. He used objects to kill his victims with blunt force trauma, and he shot some of them. The ones in Texas, he actually shot. So the fact that Jane Arroyo appeared to be washed clean, it doesn't necessarily rule out that Stephen Peter Morin wouldn't have washed her clean for some reason after he killed her.
Other random murderers and serial killers were moving through Nevada during the time of Jane's death. And while Joe Ebert believes Stephen Peter Morin is likely the culprit, without definitive evidence, he's hesitant to say for sure. Retired Detective John Williams, on the other hand, has a different theory.
She might have just been picked up by somebody and just kidnapped, basically. And I don't think it was a serial killer. I just think it was random.
Nearly four decades after Jane Arroyo Grande Doe was found off State Route 146, Detective Joe Ebert believes he's exhausted all the avenues that forensic DNA can provide for identifying her. Then, in 2019, while consulting with the Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the FBI, Joe learns about a genealogist who has helped solve several cold cases in recent years, including the famous Golden State Killer case.
Quite often, once you solve who the person is, then you solve who did it.
Barbara Ray Venter is a retired patent lawyer turned genetic genealogist. Her revolutionary research methods have led to breaks in many unsolved homicide investigations.
When we first announced we'd identified the Golden State Killer, it was amazing how many phone calls I got. We're up to 16 people in my group. We're working pretty much around the clock, 7 days a week. I actually do a number of cases for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They gave my name to the detective on the case, Joe Ebert, and so Joe contacted me about working on the case. He's obviously very excited about doing the genetic genealogy work, and so he's actually been very involved. And in fact, the conference that we met at in Las Vegas, we got so involved in talking about the case and genealogy, we ended up sitting there talking all day, and I didn't go to any of the meetings.
With forensic DNA, Barbara Rae Venter identifies victims or suspects by building a family tree from genealogy databases. In the case of Jane Arroyo Grande Doe, there isn't much DNA to work with. Jane's bone material has been all but ruined, and the rootless strands of hair collected at autopsy are thought to be useless for extracting DNA. But to Joe's surprise, Barbara knows of a lab in California doing groundbreaking work on rootless hair, using a method called whole genome sequencing.
One of the new techniques that is available is to be able to isolate autosomal DNA from rootless hair. This technology is much more powerful. You're isolating the DNA from the hair shaft to these little tiny fragments, and then you're running this procedure called genome sequencing, which uses various markers that are in the DNA to know where to put the pieces together. It was not known that there was any nuclear DNA in the hair shaft. It was known there was mitochondrial DNA, but not nuclear DNA. And it turns out as the hair is growing, the cells actually go through a process called apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. And in that process, the nuclear DNA gets chopped up into little tiny pieces. And so they were too small to be detected by usual PCR technology. So this is actually basically the same technique that was used in the Human Genome Project. There, they deliberately tore the DNA into little tiny pieces and then put it all back together again. It was called shotgun sequencing. In this case, we're actually starting off with fragmented DNA.
The fragmented DNA from Jane's rootless hair is put back together through the genome sequencing process. What seemed to be impossible 40 years ago when John Williams first caught the case is suddenly a reality. Joe Ebert finally has his Jane Doe's DNA signature and a possible way to ID her once and for all.
So when you think about the time frame of where we are with this case, we have worked this case from October 5th, 1980, and have really made no leaps and bounds in identifying who Jane Arroyo Grande Doe is, until about a year and a half ago when I met Barbara Rae Venter. And between my partner and I, we have made huge leaps and bounds to identify numerous family members that we believe are genetically related to Jane Arroyo Grande Doe. They might not know who she is, but we can show that they are genetically related to her. And until we can ultimately identify someone that's pretty close in relationship to her, and we can start going and talking to these people and saying, hey, we have an unidentified victim. Is there anyone in your family that you know that's missing a loved one? And ultimately get lucky. And that's where we are with it.
I think what really drives me on working on these cases is the victims and wanting to give them justice, give them a name, whatever the situation is. Because I have to tell you, some of these cases are horrendous. I guess I've led a very sheltered existence because it has truly shocked me the amount of evil that is out there that is exemplified in some of these cases. They are just awful. In Arroyo Grande, a couple of things. One is, of course, giving her back her name. And then, of course, her family probably has absolutely no idea what happened to her, whether she's alive or not. So it will, of course, be helpful for them, if there are still family members who are alive, to know what happened, that she hasn't just been not communicating, she hasn't been able to communicate.
John, he goes back to her gravesite every year. There isn't a year that goes by that I don't get a phone call since I took this case over in 2014, beginning of 2015, that John hasn't called me on the day of her recovery of her body. And that's October 5th every year. It's a constant reminder.
I think about it every day. We have pictures of her in my den, in my back room and stuff. And it's just, she just basically feels like family to me. And we're still looking, and we're going to find out who she is and who did it. technology and my prayers will do it.
To see a composite of Jane Arroyo Grande Doe, or if you have any information about her identity, please submit your tip to the Henderson Police Department Investigations Bureau at 702-267-4750 or at unsolved.com. Next on Unsolved Mysteries.
The issue for us was it's such a big complex and people are always in and out. I guess it's quite possible that they blended in with the foot traffic in the morning. We did several canvases the days following, trying to see people going to work. If anyone that didn't look like they belonged, then we came up unsuccessful.
Unsolved Mysteries is a production of Cosgrove Muir Productions and Cadence 13. It is executive produced by Terry Dunmuir and Chris Corcoran. Produced by Lloyd Lockridge, Christine Lennig, Courtney Ennis, Paige Heimson, and Paul Yates. The story producer for this episode was Caitlin Cutt, and it was edited by Roy Hurst. From Cadence 13, editing, mixing, and mastering by Chris Basil, Andy Jaskiewicz, and Bill Schultz. Production support by Sean Cherry and Ian Mont. Artwork and design is by Kirk Courtney. Publicity by Josephina Francis and Hilary Schuff. The original theme music was composed by Gary Malkin and Michael Boyd. Thanks for listening to episode 30 of Unsolved Mysteries.